I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And this is one of those mixed-up stories about U.S. immigration policy and 9/11 and the turmoil of West Africa, but it's also the story of one man, a teacher, a high school math teacher in Boston who, because of his relationship with his students, sits here in The Connection studio with me instead of entering his fourth month of incarceration at the Suffolk County Jail. But I'm getting ahead of myself. This story of Obain Atuman started 12 years ago when he found himself on the wrong side of politics in his hometown of Abidjan in Ivory Coast. Back then, 12 years ago, he fled to the United States and he put in his claim for political asylum. He got a work permit, and while his claim was being assessed, he started teaching in Boston, working his way up to a position at Fenway High School, teaching math and advising students. Well, finally, he got a letter calling him to an immigration hearing to explain his claim for political asylum. And that's where the story took a turn for the worse. Now, I invite you to listen along today to Obain's story. Join us with your own thoughts. Do you think that the immigration system needs to be tougher since 9/11? Do you believe that some people who might make great citizens simply have to leave the country to make the country itself safer? Or would you like to see the individual story take priority over national security and strict immigration laws? Does there need to be a little more elasticity in the way the law is enforced? Well, you know our number. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined in the studio by Obain Atuman, and his lawyer, Susan Cohen, is here as well. Obain, thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
Susan, nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Obain, let's pick this story up. June 7th, 2001, if I'm not mistaken, is when you were supposed to show up to an immigration hearing, but you didn't go, right?
I didn't go.
What happened?
I didn't go because I misread the date. I mistook the June 7th date for July 27th.
It was July handwritten 7th.
It was a handwritten date. And a couple of days later, I realized that I had misread it. So I contacted a lawyer who tried to have the motion reopened on June 19th.
And what did the judge at that point say, or the immigration people?
That motion was denied on July 20th. And we appealed the decision with the Boston BIA, which is the Board of Immigration Appeals, and the appeal was dismissed. And that was in February 8th, 2002.
Okay, so that's about 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago.
Right.
And at that time, Obain, what were they saying? Were they saying that you were going to be deported? What were you being told by the government?
At that time, nothing was clear. When I spoke to the attorney, after the appeal was dismissed, I didn't really have much contact with the attorney because he said he couldn't do much after that.
But the immigration department at that point, had they said, look, you have not shown us reason why you should be here for political asylum. You have we have denied you the appeal. So was the natural conclusion to that, hey, you're going to have to go back to Ivory Coast?
I think when it comes to legal aspect, because I didn't get any letter, from an immigration official saying,
it's time to go. And you were teaching at this time.
I was teaching at that time.
So you kept on with your teaching.
I kept on doing my job until...
until you got your car towed.
I got my car towed in November 25th.
November 25th of 2003.
This
is just about four months ago.
Just one day before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And I just went to... get my car back. And seven policemen showed up at the car towing place. And then
were they waiting for you there? Or
no, I think one of the workers there called them because they had, maybe they've had a previous conversation before I got there.
I gotcha.
So, they called them, just let them know that I was there. And I sat there waiting for them to release my car. I sat there for about 30, 35 minutes, and I didn't understand why it was taking that long.
And then the police showed up.
What
did they do?
They come and ask me for my name, and I say, well, my name is Obain. I told them I was surprised to see the policeman walk up to me and ask me what my name was. So I say, my name is Obain Atuma. And he said, have you ever been in trouble with the law before? And I said, no. Have you ever, committed a crime before? I said, no. Have you ever been in front of a judge? I said, no. So he went back and he spoke to somebody on the phone and came back to me. Because I think at that point he knew he probably had a warrant, but he didn't know what the warrant was for. So he came back to me and said, "Well, do you have any weapons on you?" I said, "No," and I was coming from school. I had no reason. I mean, I've never had a weapon on me in the first place. So we're gonna have to arrest you. At that point, I didn't want to resist arrest. I said, okay.
But did they say why you were being arrested?
Yeah, they didn't tell me the reason until I got to the police station that it was for an immigration violation. And they asked me if I knew the details of it. I said, well, I don't. I mean, my lawyer was handling that aspect of my life. So if you could call him, that would be a good idea. But it was late in the afternoon. It was early in the evening, around 6 o'clock. So everything, one day before Thanksgiving, all the offices were closed. So I stayed at the police station on the 25th, 26th, and 27th. And I was taken to a Suffolk County jail on the 28th.
And let's bring another voice into the conversation here, because when school resumed the next week at Fenway High, Mr. Atuman was not there. Brian Rose is a student who knows this part of the story. He's been listening in on the phone. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Tell me what the word was at Fenway High when Mr. Atuman didn't show up after Thanksgiving.
Well, we were all somewhat puzzled. It was, a bit peculiar not to see him. But we weren't actually informed of the details of what had happened to him until months later. I mean, we were all, very skeptical about not seeing him. But for all we knew, it could have been just a bad virus.
Now, so you didn't know whether or not he was arrested. You didn't know he was in Suffolk County Jail at that point?
No, I actually did not know this until a couple months later.
So what were people told? That he was sick? That he wasn't there? What was the word of the school?
Well, there really wasn't much word at the school. People just assumed it was just some natural, regular thing. But, I mean, after I had finally found out, I mean, the feelings, that I had could only be described as just complete and utter shock. I mean, to have someone who has meant so much to you for nearly a decade just leave you to await certain disaster in another country is just unthinkable.
Brian, I want you to hang on just half a second, because
sure.
I want to also hear from Susan Cohen, because Susan, who's a lawyer with Mintz Levin here in Boston, that's about the time that you got involved, isn't it?
When
O'Bain was in jail?
Yes, we found out that O'Bain was in jail and that the school wanted to try to do something to help him and that the students needed him, and that's when we got involved to see what we could do to help.
And under the circumstances, what were you faced with? Was this a let's see if we can get him out of jail story, or was this let's see if we can, keep him from being deported to Ivory Coast? What were you dealing with?
All of the above. I mean, we wanted to get him out of jail because he's not a criminal. He doesn't deserve to be behind bars. He needed to be teaching. His students needed him. So number one, we wanted to get him out of jail. And we wanted to talk with the Immigration Service to see what other steps could be taken to keep him from harm.
Now, what kind of options did you have? Not many, I understand. I mean, more often than not, people in O'Bain's situation like that end up being deported, don't they?
That's right. Most people don't have a chance in that situation. But fortunately, O'Bain is such a central figure in his school community that he just inspired unbelievable support in the community. And he's very fortunate for that.
Brian Rose, what did you and the other students do?
Well, we were informed of it. We were informed of the goings on, and we made tons of picket signs. The first rally we had, the first demonstration was pretty small. It was in front of our school. We had roughly 60 to 70 kids who were in support of O'Bain. But then a few days later, we took about 200 to 300 BAA and Fenway students. We added BAA as well, and we went in front of the JFK building near Government Center. And we had a huge rally. A couple of Massachusetts officials were there. I think Felix Arroyo was one of them. He showed his support for O'Bain. So, yeah, those are the first initial actions that we took, yeah.
Now, I have a question for you, Brian, and I hate to confess this, but I don't know that I would have gone rallying in support of my high school math teacher. What is it about this man here that got people going?
Well, at least for me, You know, most people have, you know, a brother or a sister or a close friend to help them out with life. Well, I'm an only child, and my friends can't take anything seriously. So while other people have siblings or friends, I have it one up on them. I have Obeyan Altamont, and I wouldn't – he's just my mentor, and I wouldn't trade him for anything. And, you know, I just can't believe, you know, what's going on. And I think but you know, that's for me because I've known him for nearly a decade, a very long time. But as far as the people in his family who haven't known him for so long, I would say just, you know, he's such a helpful person. I mean, this is a selfless, caring individual who only lives to help and never lives to hurt. I mean, he is such a cool, calm demeanor. I mean, he'll almost never get angry at you. He's if there was a perfect human being, which I don't think there is, you would say it was him.
So, Obeyan, this is fairly high praise, but I need to move it ahead. You're sitting in jail at this point. Do you know this is going on? Do you know that there are students rallying to try and help you out?
No, I didn't. I didn't know when the first rally happened until the next day when it came in the newspaper, and one of the correction officers called me, and he had a copy of the Herald, and he showed it to me. And then later on that day, the news came on Channel 7. He called me out of the cell. Not really moved me to tears, and I just stood there and I started crying because it was hard. It was incredible, and it was knowing that you had all the support for you out there. And the other good thing that happened is that a lot of correction officers, the attitude changed towards me on that day. You know, they extended favors to me. They asked me to stay out of the cell instead of being locked up all the time. And so it was good. It was good to know that, you know, my students were out there and supporting me.
Now, the other thing that some of our listeners may not know is that prior to coming to the United States, you had seen the inside of a jail cell already in Abidjan, right?
Absolutely. It's one of those things that you don't. One of those experiences that you don't want, you're not too proud to have had. But in Abidjan, the same thing happened to me on a few occasions. And actually, the first time I had, I had troubles for political activities.
You belonged to the wrong party.
Just you belong to the wrong party. And for my whole entire life, I've been, you know, one that wants democracy. Because and that's one of the things that I really want to establish in a classroom environment. I think that having democracy in a classroom is critical, and having a democracy in a society is even more critical for the development of that society. And the Ivory Coast, unfortunately, a lot of the leaders that we had at that time didn't want democracy because democracy was something that was against their personal interest. They were not in power for the interest of the people. They were in power for their own interest.
I just need to stop you there for half a second. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and continue the story of Obeyan Altamont, who is here in the Connection studio with me, but still waiting to hear from the Immigration Department. Although he is out of jail, he is not out from underneath a deportation order that is supposed to send him back to the country of his birth. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we take a look at Obeyan's particular story and see what that tells us about immigration policy and how it's changed since 9/11. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And just before we went to the break, we had Obeyan Altamont sitting in the Suffolk County Jail, getting the first hints that people outside were thinking that perhaps it wasn't appropriate to have him spending his time in jail there. Students at Fenway High School, some of them in his classroom, others who were just decided to join in, were rallying in support of him. Obeyan, let's before we leave the jail and go to the next part of the story, I'm wondering whether or not you thought there was something ironic in that you left Ivory Coast because you were locked up there, and here you are in the United States, locked up here.
There was an irony that I actually really I kept thinking about while I was in there. I left the Ivory Coast because I was running away from persecution, and I wanted to come to a country where I would be allowed to say what I think and do what I am good at, you know, without running the risk of being arrested or being thrown in jail for, you know, doing basically nothing.
Okay, now, but there are going to be people listening along who say, yeah, you did nothing. You had your chance to go to a judge. You missed the hearing. These are the rules. You didn't play by the rules. And so, tough luck.
I just wanted to, at least to the judge, a judge to hear my case, not just dismiss it without even, you know, giving me a chance, you know, just for missing a date. I understand that it was it's a law, but sometimes the law has to give people chances of actually presenting the case instead of, now, how would they feel if they had to be deported or sent back to a country where they would run the risk of being thrown in jail or even killed?
Would you today just run that risk if you went back to Abidjan?
Yes. Yeah? Or for missing a date.
Okay. Now, we'll talk a little bit more with Susan about how the laws have changed, but let's wrap our story here. At some point, the rallying seems to have worked. You get what? A word from inside the jail that it's time to leave. What are you thinking? That it's time to be deported?
Oh, I was just sitting there, one of the correctional officers came up and said, you have to pack up your things. You're leaving. I said, where am I going? He said, well, I don't know. He didn't know. He didn't have a clue where I was going. I say, so you have to go downstairs to the immigration office and they will let you know. So I grabbed my plastic bag and put my small Bible in it and walked downstairs. So I get there, there were about five other people waiting. And one of the officers told, he was speaking to the whole group, and he said, well, we're going to be on our way to the airport in about 5 minutes. And I was sitting there, we are actually going to the airport. I could not believe what was happening. And it just...
You thought that was it?
I thought that was it. Until a couple of minutes later, another one came and said, "Oh no, you will be you're going to be coming to the JFK building downtown," and that was that was the biggest news I've ever had in the last 4 months. Sitting there, going to the JFK building, which is the opposite direction of
the airport.
The airport. So and then I started having some hope at that point, and until we got to the JFK building, and I was put in another cell there for maybe 35 to 40 minutes waiting for one of the officers. He came back later and took pictures of me and did the paperwork and asked me to leave. And I said, leave? What do you want? Where am I going? He said, well, you're going home. Wow. I could not even believe I was going home. And, you know, I asked him to use the phone. And first, he told me to go downstairs to use the phone. And I said, well, I don't have a penny on me at this point. So he said, okay, you can use the phone, but do it quick. And he allowed me to make a call.
You called a friend, Susan, then you found out about it shortly after?
Yes, I was with one of O'Bain's friends at the time, wondering where he might be. And we get this phone call that he's out on the street. We couldn't believe it. We raced down there to pick him up. And there was O'Bain just standing on the street, blinking in the sunlight, in complete and total shock. I just threw my arms around him. We were so happy to see him.
And how long after that time were you back at Benway High School then? Because
About an hour.
Yeah.
About an hour.
We just took stock of the situation and brought him right to his kids.
Brian Rose is a sophomore there. Brian, were you at the school when Mr. Atuman came back?
Yes, I was.
Tell me about that.
Oh, it was a very jubilant occasion. I mean, I think basically every Fenway High School student and many BAA kids were there to greet him. When O'Bain took the mic, he couldn't get a word in edgewise because everyone was cheering too much.
These guys like you.
Yep.
I mean, I love them. I love them, and I think I've had a really strong relationship with my students. And they're my little brothers and sisters. That's the way I see it. And I just, it's the only people, I don't have a family here. My family is back in the other because they're my family here.
So what did you say to them in the auditorium late last week?
I told them that, you know, I really thank them for what they did. What they had done. I mean, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be out there. I wouldn't be out here today. And what they actually did was a proof of the something that goes against a widespread belief that young people today or not or detached from what goes on in their society. And it was evidence that even young, even teenagers, can actually participate in their community life. And the students at Fenway actually proved it. Fenway High School, is a school that emphasizes a community life. And anything we do at Fenway is about having, building a community. And the students really, this is something that they live by.
Brian Rose, did that message get through on that day?
Oh, definitely. I think it really shows that, just because you're not an adult doesn't mean you can't make a difference.
I want to thank you for being with us, Brian. I'm going to say goodbye to you now because we've got a number of callers who want to join us on the line. So
great talking to you, Dick.
Thanks for your time. Brian Rose, a sophomore at Fenway High School in Boston. 1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation this hour. We're going to go first to Newton, Massachusetts. Alex is joining us there. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the program.
Yeah.
I share in Mr. Obeng Atuma's grief. Just like in his case, about 12 years ago, I came to this country fleeing from persecution from the country of Cameroon in West Africa, and I applied for political asylum in 1993. My interview never came up until 1998, and when I went for the interview, I was told by this officer that I'm an economic immigrant. So that was the end of the story. And I had an appeal. I went in front of the judge, and the judge sided with the officer. And one of the things they said in that in the case was that the problems of the Cameroon is fine, so I can go back. And in 2001, the appeal was denied, and I was ordered.
Alex, are you there? We seem to have lost
the line. Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
And I was ordered deported.
So why are you still here, Alex?
Yes. Then in July of 2003, I was put at the Bristol County House of Correction until I was released recently. That was about January 15th. What helped me was my involvement with my community activities. I've always been an advocate, and since I've been in this country, I've been working with the community. One of the messages that I've been taking out to this community is that our values, the family values in America is becoming an endangered species. So I'm trying, as a new immigrant, to bring in this family value that is still very valuable with us, the new immigrant.
Alex, was it the community that helped you remain in the United States?
Yes. I had many people in the community, people like Dr. David Herzog in Newton, who is actually hosting me right now, all the friends that I used to meet when I used to help him. They wrote letters. The Cameroon community signed affidavits, and they also vowed for me that if they send me back to Cameroon, the dictator government there is going to kill me.
So Alex, just before I let you go, what's your status now? Are you an American citizen? What's your status?
Not yet. I'm just like Mr. Obeng. I just got released one night at about midnight. They came to my cell. They said to me, "Pack your things," and I packed them. And they said, "We are taking you to dispatch." Took me to dispatch, and about 2:30 in the morning, they brought me downtown to.
They could deport you, but they haven't. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Because of the strong community support that I had, unfortunately, not too many people have this kind of support.
I hear you on that, Alex, and I actually want to stop you there and bring Susan Cohen in, because, Susan, you're a lawyer. You deal with these sorts of cases. What difference did it make to have the students in Obain's case speak out for him, to have the community in Alex's case speak out for him? What difference does that make in the immigration process? Do you know?
It does make a difference. It obviously made a difference in the caller situation and made a difference in O'Bain's situation. What's unfortunate is that it shouldn't make a difference if someone can prove that they're not a flight risk, that they're going to run away from the government and that they're going to follow the orders of the government. There's no reason for non-criminals to be locked up in that interim period. If someone is a citizen who is not a danger to the community and is not a flight risk, there's no reason that our tax dollars should be spent, in my opinion, keeping them behind bars when they're not criminals and people could be contributing to society in the meantime while their cases get decided.
Let's take another call from Brighton, Massachusetts. Nicholas is on the line. Nicholas, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for Susan Cohen as well. I was wondering, is this a normal sort of reaction or a normal process? You know, both of these gentlemen seem to, as you said, they're not criminals. They're not. They don't seem to be risks to society. Is it normal for them to be thrown in jail for simply missing their first appointment? Certainly, I think if I missed some kind of court hearing, I would probably be able to get it rescheduled, but they get deported for that. And I was wondering if the reaction to immigration violations has become more dramatic since 9/11.
All right, Nicholas, thanks for that.
That's an excellent question, and in fact, it's because our policies have changed since 9/11 that this is happening exactly. It was in December of 2001 that our government instituted a change where data regarding immigration violations was being entered into the National Crime Information Center database that contains the data regarding criminals in this country. And they deputized police officers around the country to act on this information and lock up people with immigration violations instead of focusing only on people with criminal violations.
So when the car was towed under the earlier rules, that wouldn't necessarily have put O'Bain's name up on the police computer, is that right?
That's correct.
But some people would say, Susan, that maybe that's not such a bad thing, that there are so many people who are living underneath the immigration radar that to get the police involved there is, you know, is one way of preventing another 9/11.
I'm not an apologist for that. I believe that's true, that it's not necessarily a bad thing in every case, but there are, you know, in the broad strokes, a lot of very good people are being kept behind bars and separated from their families, and it's extremely traumatic, and they're not dangerous to society at a minimum. These people who are not dangerous, who are in fact contributing members of society like O'Bain, should have been released. There's no reason to keep him behind bars in that period of time.
O'Bain, when you were in Suffolk County Jail, were you talking with other people who were also there for the same
thing? Oh, yes, and I was actually teaching somebody in my cell, teaching him English. I was a Brazilian, really good Brazilian man who actually owns a business, a construction business in Somerville. He bought a house and has a family. He was in there for the same reason I was in there.
He missed a hearing.
He missed a hearing, and he ended up in there. And he wanted to take advantage at that time to learn English. So he was in my cell, so every day I took about an hour and a half to have class with him. And he even said that if he was, he had the chance to come out, he would call him. He could call me so we can continue our classes. And there are a lot of good people in that. You know, a lot of good people that I got to know in there.
Like half a dozen or 20, 50?
On my floor. Yeah. On my floor, there were about 60, 65 people. And there were three floors. So in the whole building, you probably were talking about 200, probably about 200 people just in that building that I was in.
Who were there on an immigration violation?
Immigration violation, some with the criminal records, some without. So,
Susan, was there not also a change after 9/11 where these people don't qualify for bail as quickly as they would have in years past?
Yeah, the standards have been tightened up. And a lot of people who would otherwise have made bond or bail in the past are no longer able to do so, so they remain behind bars.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take another call from Savannah, Georgia. Kyle is joining us. Kyle, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I feel for your guest what they're going through. The problem is that immigration not only needs reform, immigration needs massive change, because the problem is they try to cover their mistakes by putting the blame on these poor immigrants, and I'm one of the examples.
Where are you from originally, Kyle?
I'm originally from Sudan, and I moved to the United States. Been married for 6 years now, and when immigration sent me a letter telling me that I was supposed to report for an appointment to remove the conditions on my green card, and I was in the, at that time I had moved from the state that I was living in, which was in Virginia, to Georgia. And I had already sent to that office a letter saying, hey, I have moved. This is my new address. And I went to the immigration office in Georgia, and I said, I have moved from Virginia. Do I still need to report to Virginia? They said, no, you don't have to report to Virginia because you're not under their jurisdiction. Your file will be moved here. And they took my information, my new address, and they said, when we receive your file from Virginia, we'll send you a letter with a different appointment. I waited for an entire year and a half and kept going back and forth asking what is going on with my file. And then finally they come and say, well, your file basically is being closed because you have not reported to Virginia. And if it wasn't for my wife's detailed ability and keeping record of every single piece of letter and information that we have sent to immigration, I would have ended up basically in the same situation as he was.
So in your view, then, Kyle, it has more to do with sort of overall incompetence rather than
exactly.
A tightening up?
Exactly.
And the immigration department makes a mistake, it's your fault.
Exactly. Instead of them coming and saying, you know, we made a mistake, no. They go and say, well, what's the easiest thing? These people are immigrants. They're weak. They're going to be scared. They're probably going to be intimidated, and in the meantime, the funny part is that I have joined the military, and if it wasn't for people in the military who stood up for me and helped me, like I said, I would have ended up in the same situation as your guest, if not worse.
Kyle, I want to thank you for calling in. It was nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Once again, a story about people relying on friends and contacts and community to help them get out from underneath the arm of the Immigration Department. Paula Grenier is a spokesperson for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Boston. We had invited them to be with us on the program to talk about Obeyn Atuman's case. And they've given us a statement instead. The statement says that Obeyn is still under a final order of removal. That means although he is out of Suffolk County Jail and living at home and contemplating going back to the classroom, he could be deported to Ivory Coast at any time. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Join us with your thoughts about the state of immigration in America today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Obeyn Atuman is with me here in the studio. He's a teacher at Fenway High School in Boston, was born in Abidjan in Ivory Coast, and left there in 1992 after running into trouble with politics, belonged to the party that wasn't in power, and kept finding himself in jail. So he's been in Boston now for the past 12 years and was jailed in the United States about 4 months ago when he missed an immigration hearing to make his case for being a political refugee. What's it called, Obeyn?
Political asylum.
Asking for political asylum, right. And was released just 6 days ago, though remains under threat of deportation. He's here in the studio with me, with Susan Cohen, who's his lawyer. She's a partner with Mintz Levin based here in Boston. Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to have you join us. Now, I got to think, too, Obeyn, that there are people who are listening thinking, no, wait a second. You've been here for 12 years, so you were here on 9/11. You know how earth-shattering that moment was for this country. You watched people right across the country go, wow, how did these guys get in here? We can't allow this to happen. There must have been a part of you then thinking, I better get my own affairs in order so I don't get swept up in some kind of immigration crackdown. Did you think about that at the time?
Yes, I did. I did. But at that point, there was not much I could do because it was all in the hands of the courts. And I mean, whatever I could do, I had done before. I had already done. So I was just, there was nothing else I could do in addition to what I had already done.
Were you thinking at the time, man, 9/11 means I'm out of here?
Oh, yeah. And I wasn't the only person saying that. I mean, in the immigrant community, yeah. that was the word that, you know, things were going to get tighter and everybody was getting very scared of the implications of that 9/11 was going to have on immigration and immigrants in this country.
And Susan, around about that time, shortly thereafter, tied up with the Patriot Act, Attorney General John Ashcroft also, in tightening up the rules, made the processing of cases like O'Bain's a lot more efficient. Well, efficient if you're with the government, but not so efficient if you're someone like O'Bain. What changed then?
That's exactly right. And O'Bain and many other people have gotten caught up in that as a result. The Board of Immigration Appeals is actually the court of appeals for people, for immigrants whose cases are heard and denied at the first level before an immigration judge. The only chance they have to appeal is to the Board of Immigration Appeals in Washington. And Attorney General Ashcroft issued orders, and it's important for people to know that that board is actually a creation of the Attorney General. It's not an independent body. Mm-hmm. But it's the place where the judges reside who hear appeals of immigration decisions from immigrants. Primarily, it's the immigrants who are appealing their denials of the cases. He cut the number of judges in half, from about 23 to 11, and they issued a policy encouraging the judges to get through their caseloads and their backload and to issue affirmances without opinion, meaning to just rubber stamp the lower court's opinion without looking into what actually took place before the immigration judge.
So it just would say on the file, to be deported.
Yes, like affirmed. Judge's decision affirmed, 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 and the rate of affirmances skyrocketed in that period of time.
So as a lawyer, can you go back and look at his file? Can you look at what the judges said or did with it along the way? Is there any point in the process where someone said political asylum denied for these reasons?
No. O'Bain, in effect, in my opinion, never got due process of law, which foreign nationals are entitled to. They are persons under our Constitution. No, we can't do that because he's never had a chance to go in front of a judge.
Let's go to Lincoln, Rhode Island now. Keith is joining us on the phone from there. Keith, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. I guess I'm going to be the lone voice trying to make the big picture point that there is some benefit to what is happening here.
Okay, talk to me.
Yeah, I was a former INS special agent in Los Angeles and dealt with aliens who had been had orders of deportation. And I think there are some big picture points. One of them is your guest, although he sounds like a wonderful teacher, the kind of teacher I want my kids to have, he has had some due process. My sense is an asylum officer interviewed him and determined that he did not have a credible fear of returning to his country. And then he missed his hearing. I think he admits that he made that mistake. He missed his hearing. That was his opportunity to tell an immigration judge that to show to them that the asylum officer was wrong. And then he was able to appeal to the Board of Immigration Appeals. And although the attorney has said that it was a rubber stamp, I'm sure that his file, which includes all of the documents, were reviewed by the people on BIA.
My understanding, Keith, and I won't speak for Susan and O'Bain here, but my understanding is that the request for appeal in this case wasn't the opportunity to make the case. It was just like, can I have an appeal? And the immigration department said no. Am I right with that, Susan?
He made an appeal, but it was effectively not reviewed. I don't believe that.
Made appeal means, O'Bain, you had a chance to say, here's why I deserve to stay in the United States?
No, he appealed the fact that the judge didn't allow him to go to his hearing because he missed the date. He wanted an opportunity to go in front of the judge and explain why he innocently missed the date. The judge denied that motion to reopen his case here in Boston. And then his lawyers at the time appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals the decision of the judge not to give him an opportunity to go in front of her to make his case.
The bottom line, O'Bain, is that you never actually stood in front of a judge to make your case.
No, I never did. The only opportunity I had, the caller said that I had a chance to speak to an immigration officer for the first interview. But, just want to make it clear to him that, at that time, I did not have a lawyer with me. I couldn't afford a lawyer. I was only making maybe $16,000 to $17,000 a year, and I was paying for graduate school at the same time.
Let's go back to Keith here on this one, though. So, Keith, you keep it in the big picture for me, if you would.
Well, I think one of the other big picture points is his arrest based on picking up the car. And I am very heartened by that because One of the things that was very frustrating when I was with INS was that the only people who could make immigration arrests were immigration officers. And there are very few special agents and deportation officers away from the border, not Border Patrol agents.
Right.
And so, in fact, the linking of those databases is critically important because it increases, in this case, your guess may not be specifically dangerous, but the reality is the people come into the immigration system when they're released from jails, when they're released from prisons, as well as when they have denied claims for asylum.
And I think Susan acknowledged that there's some value in having that link up there. I certainly know the point that you're making, Keith, but come around to the big picture point that the folks here in the studio are making, and that is that it seems like under the circumstances of someone who wants to stay in the country and doesn't appear, at least from my perspective here, to be a great danger to the country, that the avenue of appeal or the opportunity to say, can I have one last word on my behalf, seems to be a little bit foreshortened under the circumstances that we're talking about now. Would you buy that?
I wouldn't. And the reason I wouldn't is you set up systems so that people have fairness. And the problem that we have here is if there's a negative result, a good teacher, a good man is going to be deported. The problem is you don't set up a system for cases like this. You know, we have to look at this. He made an error. He had an opportunity to appear to appear in front of an immigration judge, and he missed it. We expect our people to make their hearings. The other thing to remember is you have to focus on this. An asylum officer listened to him, even if he didn't have an attorney. You know, if he was in jail because of his political beliefs in his native country, those are the sorts of things that these asylum officers do. And they didn't believe him.
Okay,
and
Keith,
as an agent, I saw a great deal of fraud in among asylees. And I'm not saying he was committing fraud.
I get you, but I also want to have Obain sort of speak back to you on this. He's saying, you know, no reason that you should necessarily have to leave the country, but, you know, you have to have a system, and you're on the wrong side of the system.
I mean, it's a good thing that we have a system, and I'd like the system to really work. And I like to have a system, but I want a system that's really effective, that a system that can really sort out in cases and make an objective assessment of cases based on their merit.
I would agree with that. I mean, I was, unfortunately, not Obain's lawyer when he first came to the country. I wish I had known him then. But my understanding is that he sat in front of an asylum officer for his very first time without counsel, and that the officer didn't say that he or she didn't believe everything that Obain was saying about his fear. The officer didn't believe that he was a teacher back in the Ivory Coast. And it's unfortunate that people who are represented and can provide more documents sometimes have their cases approved when people who are not represented and don't know what to bring to the interview just on the basis of their honest statements in front of an officer are sometimes not believed just on the basis of what they say.
Keith, are you still there?
I am.
Last word to you.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I it would be nice if he could stay here, but I do think that we just need to overall, immigration law enforcement since September 11th has been vastly improved, and I he may have been swept up in it, but the reality is I think our country is safer for it.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Well, Obain, what happens next? What do you know?
I don't know. I don't know what the decision is going to be. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. My attorneys are fighting for me to stay, and I'm just keeping my fingers crossed and just praying for the immigration to look favorably on my case.
Okay, so final order ruling stands. What Susan, can you do? My interpretation of that is that it's not a matter of if, but when.
Well, it may be true that Obain may have to leave the country at some point, but we've asked the Immigration Service to consider the circumstances and in the short term allow him to stay because he's providing a much-needed service in the community right now. His students really need him. It's the middle of the year, of the school year.
Okay, that caught him out of jail. Does it keep him in the country?
It could. We'll wait. We'll have to wait and see what happens. But at a minimum, we're trying to have the Immigration Service understand that we're talking about Obain. This is not, you know, an anonymous figure here. And he fears for his safety if he were to return to the Ivory Coast. He's made a case for that, and at a minimum, hopefully they will work with us in a reasonable manner to allow him, if not to go back there, to go to a country where he might be safe.
Now, I understand, O'Bain, that one of the men that you were actually jailed with in Ivory Coast is now prime minister of that country. Is that right?
Right. Actually, the president. The current president of the Ivory Coast was, you know, went to jail the same day, you know, I did.
So you should be safe there, no?
Oh, no, because the president has no power in his own government at this point. He just, you know, figure is sitting there. He doesn't have any real power. His prime minister is the one running the government. And it was an imposed prime minister. He didn't get to choose a prime minister. You know, he doesn't have a prime minister of his choice. So the government actually is made up of ministers of different parties, and his party, the president's party, is
so the guys who persecuted you still have power.
Absolutely, the minister of justice and the minister of the interior, which runs the police, are all run by the people who persecuted me.
Let me ask you something else, though. Do you want to live in the United States after what you've been through over the last 3 or 4 months?
Oh, I still have faith in this country. I have faith in this country, and now. And the reason why I have faith in this country, there's a system here that works. There's a political structure put in place that actually works. There are mistakes made, but I'm not going to let the mistakes change my opinion of this country, because no matter what happens, there's still justice in this country.
And are you going back to Fenway High School? What's the plan there?
I'm going to go to Fenway High School and say hi to my students. I went to the museum yesterday to say hi to one half of them. So I'm going to go there and just let them know that I'm okay, that I'll be back on Monday so we can get back to business.
Well, keep us up to date with how things go, will you?
Thank you. I will.
It was great having you here in the studio.
It was great. Thanks for having us.
O'Bain Atuman is still living with a final deportation order over his head, though the work and the efforts of the students at Fenway High School and the involvement of the community got him out of Suffolk County Jail. If you're interested in finding out a little bit more about O'Bain's case, the students at Fenway High School have created a website. We have a link to that at our website, and that's probably the easiest way for you to get there. We are at www.theconnection.org. Susan Cohen, thank you so much for being in.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Susan is a partner at Mintz Levin in Boston. A little earlier in the program, we talked with one of the students from that high school, Brian Rose. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.